get to that crude chart here in a moment. Good morning. I appreciate our reading this morning out of Luke chapter 15, and as was mentioned or alluded to, this is one of Christ's better known parables, even if you were to look outside of Christian circles. And it's a story of a man who goes to his father with a presumptuous request to receive his inheritance now. His father, for some reason, grants his request. In a short time, his son leaves home and squanders his inheritance on what the Bible describes as prodigal living. And just prior to the man making a change in his life and going back to his father, we find him penniless. He's feeding pigs, and he's even jealous of the food that he's feeding the pigs because it's better than what he himself has to eat. What brought him to this place, or at least started him on this path, can be traced all the way back to that first decision that he made. He decided that he wanted what he felt was his right now. He wanted his money. He wanted his inheritance. Had the man never made that decision, it's quite likely that he would not have found himself in the position of feeding swine later on in his life. The Bible is full of stories like this, parables, and also actual events of people who, like the prodigal son, made a poor decision. And that poor decision then led to subsequent poor decisions, and comparatively speaking, in many of the cases that we find in the scriptures, the prodigal son actually ended up in a much better place than others. David chose Bathsheba. Lot chose Sodom. Jeroboam chose idolatry. And we see the fruits of those decisions play out in their lives. David stole a man's wife and murdered. Lot found himself defending angels from being raped by a mob of men. Jeroboam ended up building golden calves that infected an entire nation for generations with idolatry. With the exception of Jeroboam, we're not really given the exact thinking each of these men had behind making these decisions, but we can know, based on how people make decisions, that these were fueled by something else, some kind of a framework of thinking that led to their poor decision. In David's case, it was likely that he felt entitlement as a king. As king, he had the right to take this woman as his wife, despite that she belonged to another man. Lot apparently disregarded the condition of the people that he would be exposing himself to, surrounding himself with, and the people of Sodom. Jeroboam decided that the people's allegiance to him as king was more important to their allegiance to God. And that way of thinking led to these various decisions. Some time ago, I ran into the chart that you see behind me here that I scribbled up here, and please bear with me for a moment while I explain this and tie this to my lesson this morning. It's from a book titled 101 Things I Learned from Engineering School. Now, I'm not an engineer. I didn't go to engineering school. I have talked with engineers, and they do, in fact, teach this. And what the chart is trying to illustrate is what level of influence you have over the cost of a project as the project progresses from design to completion. That's represented by this line here. And as the project advances from the early stages here on farther down past the design stage, we find that the influence over cost drops significantly. And once construction starts, your influence almost completely disappears. Now think about this from the aspect or the context of building a home. Your greatest influence over the cost of a home happens at the beginning of that project, at the design phase, when you decide what size to build the home, the lot that it's going to go on, the kind of floor plan, the initial big picture plans. That's really where you have control over cost. But once the foundation is laid, you have now limited all your future decisions in the framework of that foundation. You now have to build the walls, run the HVAC, run the plumbing. And if you want to affect costs at all, at that point, your options are really limited. You can leave part of the house unfinished. You can change the quality of the finish work. If you want the house to be different, you have to change something, as the graph implies. If you want to add more rooms, if you want something to be different in that part of the house, all those things are limited based on the decisions that you already made. Now, my lesson this morning is obviously not going to be about building houses or construction projects, but I want to apply this chart metaphorically to decisions that we make in our lives. It seems to me, in the cases that I've mentioned already that have occurred in the Bible, And in so many parts of our lives, decisions were made here in the design phase, so to speak, that then build the framework of thinking that lead to future decisions. And if the wrong choices are made, it can continue wrong choices on down the line. And I think Jeroboam's the clearest example of the three. Let's look into him a little bit more in depth. Jeroboam was the king of the first king of the northern kingdom of Israel. And after the nation had split into two, Jeroboam felt he had a problem because the house of the Lord, the temple, was located in Jerusalem, which was in the southern kingdom. And his people would travel there for worship. And we can see his thinking in 1 Kings chapter 12. Let's turn over there real quick and read a few verses. 1 Kings chapter 12, verses 26 and 27. And Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah." So there we see the framework of his decision making. The people's allegiance to him was more important than their allegiance to God. And that decision is what framed his future decisions. That decision was made at the beginning here, and then he would make a decision to build golden calves in a couple different cities so the people could go there to worship. If he would have recognized the opposite, that the people's allegiance to God was more important than their allegiance to him, a very different decision would have been made. So as we go through my lesson this morning, my point is very simple. It's to remind us all that choices are important, that decisions matter. Especially choices, that decisions that build a framework of how we think about things. And now, while we can all shake our head in common acknowledgement of that basic, simple fact, that decisions are important, we all witness others and ourselves forget it all the time. And we can look at the arc of people's lives unfold before our eyes and we wonder, what are they doing? Why are they doing that? Why are they making these decisions? Or we can find ourselves somewhere where we never thought we would be, and think, well, how in the world did we get here? Or even more dangerously, we never realize that we're so off base to begin with. And a lot of it happens because of decisions that we make that build the framework of our thinking. Now, this is obviously a broad topic in application. So what I plan to do this morning is look at a couple examples in the scriptures where people metaphorically made a decision here at the beginning and look at how it impacted them going forward. And lastly, we'll consider a few points that will help us avoid making the wrong decisions or in helping us deal with a situation if we find ourselves having made the wrong decision in the past. And I want to start looking over Matthew chapter 5. So if you turn over there with me, please, Matthew chapter 5. I'll be looking specifically at verse 20 there. Matthew chapter 5, verse 20 reads, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." This verse, Matthew chapter 5, verse 20, seems to be a central theme in Christ's message that he continues on through chapter 7. It's, of course, the Sermon on the Mount. What we find here and in other places in the New Testament is that the Jews had a basic misunderstanding of righteousness. In summary, they viewed righteousness as a righteousness of self, that righteousness was obtained through adherence to the law and through the following of their oral traditions. And this incorrect view of righteousness infected every part of their lives. And as Christ would bring out here in the Sermon on the Mount, righteousness wasn't just about abstaining from an outward sin, but working on the condition of the heart and the mind. Works were not to be done in public for public display, but in private where the Lord could see and for the Lord. And that's a very broad summary of what he talks about. But it's not the way the Jews viewed it. And throughout Jesus' ministry, he struggles against their paradigm as he dined with tax collectors and sinners, as he healed on the Sabbath, as the scribes and Pharisees criticized his disciples for the incorrect washing of their hands. And much of these criticisms stemmed from their basic misunderstanding of righteousness. Now, obviously, there are other things going on here. There were other things going on here. I think narrowing anyone's behavior or choices down to a single factor is usually oversimplifying things. But consider for a moment what would have happened if the Pharisees would have had and accepted the correct understanding of righteousness. It would have completely changed them. But their way of thinking completely boxed in the way they saw Jesus Christ. They had made a decision here. They had built the framework of their thinking and moved on, and they had limited all their future decisions. They had built a foundation. They had built, created a paradigm through which to view the things, and it hindered their ability to see the truth. And we see people in the world do this all the time, people all around us. People won't even entertain an ear about Jesus Christ because so many of them are convinced that there is no God. You know, how do you talk to somebody about Christ when they don't even believe in the existence of a higher power? You know, Paul dealt with this in part when he spoke in Athens. It was a bit of an opposite problem. When he spoke in Athens in Acts chapter 17, he was speaking to Greeks, of course, and they believed in false gods. And when he gave that message, he spoke to them not about Christ. He barely even mentioned Christ. He mentions Christ, or alludes to him at least towards the end of his lesson, never says him by name. But what he spoke to them about was the one God who made the world and everything in it, because they had built this world, this idea of all these false gods, but Paul had to bring them all the way back to here, tear down their thinking, and tell them that there's only one God. There's one God. And that there are so many other examples that we can point to with similar thinking. A lot of times they are not so wide sweeping as obvious as I mentioned, but things that we may give a little bit of ground on, not understanding the tangential impacts of those decisions. Maybe we consider that the creation was not really accomplished in 7 days. That's a popular theory. But what does that theory mean for the rest of the Bible? You know, you look at the Genesis, the first chapter, and it seems pretty literal, doesn't it? There was the first day, there was the second day, and there was the third day. And you're going to tell me that you start the Bible off by cooking the books, so to speak. Well, what standing does that put the rest of the Bible on? Or what about the concept that the Bible was written for the culture it addressed at the time, and that some of it no longer is really applicable? Okay, once again, what does that mean for the rest of the Bible? How does that decision affect how you view the rest of the Bible? Now, I don't bring those two things up for any other reason than most of us have probably heard those arguments. We're probably familiar with them. I don't know if anyone here holds those positions. But the point being is that decisions matter. People more and more, at least over the course of my life, have tended to trivialize decisions. You see it this way, I see it that way, and that's okay. And there are times where differences are okay. But we have to be cautious with the application for at least a couple of different reasons. First and foremost is truth. And we have to make sure that what we believe in is truth. And second, and more along the veins of what we're discussing this morning, is where those decisions will take us in the future. A really good example of this is what we believe as far as the purpose goes. What is the purpose of the church? What is the purpose of the worship service? What is the purpose for me, for us being here? And decisions we make in those areas will affect our future decisions and our behavior. Just further expanding upon that last one, if we believe that church is something that we come to for our own benefit, just our own benefit, then what we do when we're here is going to be very different than if we show up with the correct perception that we are here for God and for one another. We're going to behave differently here if we see it that way. And sometimes differences that seem trivial are really not. Not because of the one item, but because of the compounding effect of that difference. And going back to the Jews, they had constructed an incorrect view of righteousness, and it infected every single part of their lives. And the same can happen to us. Our own view of righteousness, faith, mercy, grace, baptism, what the worship service looks like, what the church looks like, the purpose of the church, what our personal service looks like, and so many other things will have compounding impacts on our future decisions. And once we build our view on that, then so many of our future decisions are filtered through that view. What we decide on these issues and so many others is important. Decisions matter. We have to look to the truth, and we have to make sure we make the right decisions. In Genesis chapter 13, Abraham, then known as Abram, and his nephew Lot stood at a bit of a crossroads. Their livestock, their flocks of livestock, had grown to a point where the land that they were on could not support one another. Abram suggests to his nephew that they part ways, and so they and their herdsmen do not get into conflict over land. And Abram gave Lot the choice. And he could choose a land. Lot could choose a land that he wanted, and Abram would go the other way. And in verses, this happens in verses 10 through 13 of Genesis chapter 12. I'm going to read that real quick. And Lot lifted his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan. This is the decision that Lot makes. Lot lifted his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go toward Zoar. Then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. But the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord. So we find when Lot's choosing where he's going to go, he chooses the plain of Sodom. And that may have not been his mistake. My understanding is that plain was large and he could have avoided Sodom. But as we see over the next few chapters, Lot grew increasingly closer to Sodom. This passage implies that he knew and he understood the wickedness of Sodom. But yet he is willing to pitch his tent at Sodom, and by the next chapter, he's dwelling in the city. And by chapter 19, he is sitting at its gates. So Lot appears to have fully invested himself within a wicked city. He had presumably given up living in a tent with his herds, as Abraham seems to have done so or continue to do so for the remainder of his life. Now, the results of this decision were disastrous. We know the story of Lot as he goes on. He found himself defending the angels who had come to deliver him out of the city because God was getting ready to destroy it. As they're fleeing the city, him, his wife, and the rest of his family, his wife turns into a pillar of salt because she looks back at the city and longed for the city as they were fleeing its destruction. Once Lot had fled the city, he settled with his daughter in the mountains. They had the idea to get their father drunk and lay with him in order that they may conceive children. And I wonder if this thought that they had would have ever come to the mind of these women had they not been exposed to the depravity of Sodom. And I think this is a speculative answer, but I would assume no, probably not, would not have. And all these series of events started because of his seemingly level of comfort with Sodom. Had he stayed away from the city, I would guess that things would have turned out very differently for Lot and his family. But that choice right there made a big difference for him. The circumstances he put himself in at Sodom led to all this falling apart. Now, Lot and Sodom may be an extreme example of making a poor decision, but let's break it down to its very basic points. We're not told why Lot chose Sodom or why Lot continued to live in Sodom, but we have to assume that there was something there that he wanted. There was something there that he treasured. And he put that above what he would be exposing himself to in his family. In essence, he mixed up his priorities and ignored the influence of his circumstances. And what was the result? Ultimately, it was sin on the part of his wife and his daughters, and I would argue him as well. And when you break it down to those basic terms, Lot's situation really isn't all that uncommon at all, is it? People make these kind of decisions all the time. And the circumstances we place ourselves in will have immense impact on our lives. Now, obviously, there are things in our life that we cannot control. We can't always control who we're around. We cannot always control what kind of society we live in. I suppose we have some control there, but not much. But there are a lot of things that we can control. Namely, we can control our priorities, and we do have a lot of control over what influences we allow in our lives. And speaking of priorities, let's turn over to Luke chapter 12 for a moment. Luke chapter 12, starting in verse 22, Christ begins talking about not worrying specifically for the basic needs of life. His basic point there is that God will provide for those things. And as you get down into verse 30, Christ begins talking about what really our concern should be. And I'm going to pick up in verse 31 and read through 34 of Luke 12. Seek the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added unto you. Do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell what you have and give alms. Provide yourselves money bags which do not grow old, a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches nor moths destroy. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Verse 31 is a verse that gets quoted a lot, and for good reason, but the verse I really want to zero in on is verse 34. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Treasure is a subjective object. And we mentioned, I mentioned Lot maybe had a treasure there in Sodom that made him want to live there. And treasure is a subjective object. Each of us chooses what it is that we treasure. Each of us chooses what is important to us, what we place value on. And I would argue the decision of what we treasure happens here. It's one of these decisions that provides a framework for our subsequent thinking. And once that choice is made, all the subsequent choices that we make down the line get filtered through that choice. We have created the box in which we make our decisions. We have built the foundation upon which we build our house, which will largely be defined by that foundation of what we treasure. What our treasure is will be what we spend our time on. It will be what we shape our life around. It will direct what we allow to influence us. And that is why that is a decision that's made here at the beginning. That's why it's one of those, you view that as one of those framework decisions because of how it shapes you. Once again, let's bring this back to practical. You know, our treasure does not have to lead us to the cesspool of sin like Sodom in order for it to negatively impact our lives. It doesn't have to go that far. All it really has to do is take up too much of our time. It just has to take a seat in our heart where God should sit. That's it. That's all it has to do for it to be a problem. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So where is our treasure? Where is our treasure? One of the things that I worried about as I was writing this lesson is that it would come across as too fatalistic, that one poor decision will automatically lead to another. If it has, I want to correct that now, because we're never lost. One poor decision does not automatically lead to another poor choice. Just as we see people in the scriptures fall down these spirals, we see so many of them lift themselves out of it or be lifted by God out of them, allow themselves to be lifted by God out of them. And the prodigal son does return to his father. Sure, he was out of money, but just because he was out of money to spend didn't mean he was out of mistakes to spend. He still had to recognize his faults. After making a poor decision, we can turn back and make the right decision. And Christ makes this point very clearly for us over Matthew chapter 21. Matthew chapter 21, he tells a parable of two sons that a father asked to work in his vineyard. Let's read a few verses there. Matthew 21, verses 28 through 31. But what do you think? A man had two sons, and he came to the first and said, "Son, go, work today in my vineyard." He answered and said, "I will not." But afterwards he regretted it and went. Then he came to the second son and said likewise, and he answered and said, "I go, sir," but he did not go. Which of the two did the will of his father? They said to him, "The first." Jesus said to them, "Assuredly, I say to you, the tax collectors and harlots enter the kingdom of God before you." And so we have here, this man tells his two sons to go, each of them individually, to go work in the vineyard. The first one says no, but then regrets that decision and then goes to work. The second one said he would, but then he didn't. And Jesus pointedly said that the one who did go in the vineyard, who said no, he wouldn't, but then go in the vineyard, was right, because he changed his mind. And at no time is this option taken away. At no point in time do we not have the option to make a different decision. Never are we in a place where we can change course or cannot immediately go back to the beginning. And we may have to live with the consequences of our decisions, but we do not have to continue on the same path. And often what is required of us is not to be afraid to go back to the beginning. Going back to the analogy of the chart I have behind us here, I think we can all relate to some kind of a project. It doesn't have to be big. It could be something small, something you worked on in your house, or if you have a hobby, whatever that hobby may be, where you're working on it, and you come along, and you just get to the place where you just wish you could just blow the whole thing up and start over, where you just wish you could, you know, give me a can of gasoline and a box of matches. I'm going to douse this thing and light it on a fire and watch it burn, and I'm just going to start over. And in those circumstances, there are usually practicalities that keep us from doing it. Maybe it's money, or maybe it's the amount of time that we've invested into that thing. When it comes to spiritual issues, our gas cans should be full and our matches should never be far away. But sometimes we may feel stuck. Sometimes even more so than when we look at a project, a physical project that we're looking on. Heavy emotions are often involved. Decisions we may have to make impact relationships that we have with close friends and even family. things we've devoted our lives to may need to change. Activities we've invested ourselves in and enjoy may have to be sacrificed or greatly reduced. And that's hard. That is hard. But too often we focus on what we will lose instead of thinking about what we will gain. You know, about 16 or 17 years ago, I sat in a class at a church meeting. And so I would have been in the first few years of college here. And he was talking about a similar subject, but more specifically, this teacher was talking about the negative influence that the wrong kind of friends had had. And you know, this wasn't the first time I had heard such a lesson before. I was just gotten out of being a teenager. I was a young adult, so this was something I had heard time and time again. And at the time, I was living somewhere where I shouldn't have been with friends and spending time with people that I shouldn't. And I don't know what it was that that person said that particular day that really made me think about it. Like I said, it's not like I hadn't heard that lesson before. But something about that day at that time really struck me. And what I ended up doing was I ended up moving in with my older brother and one of my cousins. And I remember the first Friday night that I sat in that house because they were out doing something. And I had just moved out of my friend's house. I had just left all my friends. I was 19 years old. And I was sitting alone on a Friday night, which, as nice as that may sound at, 36, at 19, that's not very cool. And I remember sitting there thinking, I have no friends. I have no one to call to do something with. And that was hard. But what I had yet to see and understand was what I had to gain from that decision. My choice to leave those things behind led me to having some of the greatest things, the most enjoying things that I have in my life today. Now, it's impossible to know for certain how things would have turned out if I would have not made that decision. But I can't, in any way, shape, or form, picture making some of the subsequent good decisions I made over the following years had I not gone back to that foundational level, changed my life, and changed things completely around. So we have to remember what we have to gain. And if that does not work, think about what we have to lose if we don't make that decision, that choice. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul in Matthew 16 and 26? What will help us in our willingness to start over or to change our minds about a certain position or belief we hold is if we instill a love for truth in our hearts. We need to make truth our treasure. That is the thing that we should desire. And in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 14, as Paul metaphorically compares how a Christian should prepare his or herself to the armor of God, to the armor of a Roman soldier, we are told to gird our waist with truth. Truth is essentially what holds everything together. In John chapter 8, verse 32, Christ tells us that the truth will set us free. And there's a lot of ways that truth will do that. But one of those ways is that it frees us from ourselves. If we can have the love of truth in our hearts, it will free us from all the things that get in the way of us seeing the truth. Pride, arrogance, stubbornness, envy, jealousy, selfishness. It is what will help us be willing to tear down the things we have built around the lies or the mistakes we have brought in the past. The love for the truth will allow us to come back to this point right here. The last point that I'll make about how we can help ourselves start over, to burn the project down, so to speak, is that we need to find the right people and listen to them. That's a really important factor. Going back to that decision I made years ago, it happened because someone else changed my thinking. They brought me back to this point here. And that's when I was able to start all over again. And there's so many verses that talk about this very thing. Proverbs chapter 15, 22. Without counsel, plans go awry, but in the multitude of counselors, they are established. Proverbs chapter 27, 17. As iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friends. Proverbs 27 and 9. Ointment and perfume delight the heart, and the sweetness of a man's friend gives delight by hearty counsel. Proverbs 1 and 5, a wise man will hear and increase learning, and the man of understanding will attain wise counsel. Proverbs 1, 8 and 9, my son, hear the instructions of your father, and do not forsake the law of your mother. All verses talking about listening to the right people. And I can look back at even my short life and see a pattern. The times that I made good decisions, it wasn't because I was smart. It wasn't because of my foresight. It was because I listened to the right people. Times that I made bad decisions, I listened to myself. And in fact, decision I made when I was 19 put me in a position where I was around more people that who were the right people to listen to. Sometimes it's hard for us to see reality. Our own emotions and desires get in the way. You know, what did it take for King David to fully realize his fault with Bathsheba? What did it take? It took Nathan telling a parable about a wealthy man, telling David a parable about a wealthy man stealing the prized lamb of a poor man. It took someone else to call him out. David was embroiled in what he was doing and needed another to bring him to his senses. And sometimes that's what we require, to find the right people and listen to them. Find the right people and listen to them. Realize that even though the decisions we might make may hurt us in a way or disrupt our lives, that we have so much to gain for and have a love for the truth. That's my lesson for you this morning, just a simple reminder that decisions are important. If there's anyone here who would like to accept Jesus Christ as their Savior, or if there's anything that this congregation can do for you, we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing the invitation song.